I was reminded of a story connected with the Buddha. And Angulimala. Angulimala was a student who came from a very wealthy family, and he was highly educated. But as a result of this, there was a lot of jealousy amongst his classmates. They hated him. And so they poisoned his teacher's mind against him. And the teacher, as punishment, thinking himself to be extremely wise, told Angulimala that your punishment is to get me 1,000 little fingers, 1,000 little fingers of the right hand. And of course, people were not willing to part with their little fingers in order to give in to Angulimala. So, by force of circumstances, he became a bandit. He had to forcefully chop people's little fingers. And like this, he became a murderer. But he went about relentlessly in his assignment. And as the number of little fingers grew, he did not know where to store them. If he kept them somewhere in the forest, the birds would take them, the animals would take them. And so he decided to wear them around his neck. And therefore, he was given the name Angulimala, finger necklace. And soon he became the most feared bandit in the land. People dreaded going through the forest because they knew that Angulimala was there. He could not be caught. He was swift, athletic, smart, and on a mission to complete what his teacher had assigned for him. Now it so happened that he had collected 999 fingers. 999, and one was left. And he was waiting for his last victim. And at that time, the Buddha decided to enter the forest. So his students warned him. They warned the Buddha that, look, Angulimala is there, and we advise you not to go into the forest now. But the Buddha, being the Buddha, said, we'll see, and with his gentle gait and disposition, started walking through the forest. Now, Angulimala saw this man approaching, and he thought, finally, my last victim has arrived. But very peculiarly, every time he tried to catch up with the Buddha, he found that the Buddha was 10 feet ahead. Every time, being as agile as he was, as athletic as he was not able to catch up with the Buddha. And he got extremely frustrated. He broke out into a sweat. He didn't know what to do. He could not believe that his 1,000 victim was so difficult to get hold of. Till out of exhaustion, he somehow managed and he came in front of the Buddha and stood and asked the Buddha, or rather told the Buddha, be still, man. I've been trying to chase you for so long. And the Buddha looked at Angulimala and said, I am still, but you be still also. And in that moment, a transmission happened. Angulimala froze. And everything around him collapsed. And he became a disciple of the Buddha. I am still, be thou still also. Not be thou happy also, not be thou joyful also. Be thou still, which is referring to a still mind. So in that instant, all these concepts fell away from Angulimala. It's quite an unusual, peculiar, and yet beautiful story connected to the Buddha. Now, this same sentiment if you read I Am That by Nisargadatta Maharaj, he was asked a very straightforward question. We are told of the bliss of non-duality. What is it? That was the question. We are told of the bliss of non-duality. And Maharaj replied that such bliss is more in the nature of a great peace. Such bliss, this lofty word called bliss, is more in the nature of a great peace. And that is why when people say that you keep talking about peace of mind all the time, it is too basic. It is too basic for the mind. But could there be anything more beautiful than living a life of peace, equanimity, calm, and tranquility? That is why when my teacher Rameshji was asked, why do you keep talking of the same thing day after day after day? You keep talking about this whole concept of non-doership for years, day after day after day. He replied, because the shell of the ego is so strong that it needs constant hammering to crack it open. I would like to touch upon one more aspect, and then I received three questions in a very similar light. We will explore that, and after that, we will open up this session for questions. This is on Rinanubandhan, relationships. You can call it the cosmic debt of relationships, as Shirdi Sai Baba referred to it. The bondage of relationships, bandhan, of the Rina, the bandhan. This is from the book A Course in Miracles. I am not starting from the beginning of this paragraph. I am just reading out what is pertinent right now. As with the first level, these meetings are not accidental, nor is what appears to be the end of the relationship a real end. Again, each has learned the most he can at the time. Yet, all who meet will someday meet again. For it is the destiny of all relationships to become holy. Nisarga Datta Maharaj, again from I Am That, one does not become a disciple by conversion or by accident. There is usually an ancient link maintained through many lives and flowering as love and trust, without which there is no discipleship. Now, the key here is love and trust. You see, if the guru is God in human form, as a representation of consciousness, you could even say your higher self or use any other such term. If there is a lack of trust, it cannot be a teacher-student relationship or guru-disciple relationship. Because you're trusting consciousness. You see, some of us would say that Angulimala's first teacher was a monster. Why did he trust him? He didn't have to cut those 999 fingers. We have a similar story in our scriptures in the Mahabharata about a guru asking an archer to gift his finger as Dakshina after all the training because he didn't want someone greater than Arjuna. It's a similar story. But if that had not happened, Angulimala would not have met the Buddha when it came to taking his 1000th victim. So events play out as per the divine blueprint and as per destiny. And that is why all masters have spoken about trust, or let's say faith in the divine grace, not faith that I will get what I want, faith that there is a higher power, God's will, you could call it, which is running the universe. You see, in the traditional Indian system of the guru-disciple relationship, many students and disciples would go to the guru and ask for advice. Oh, what should I do in this situation? I'm encountering this problem in my life. What should I do? They would go for advice, like the guru was the counselor. Now, in my case, I had a teacher who did not give such advice, because his whole teaching was that everything is God's will. And therefore, he did not know better than God. So if you went to him with a material problem, maybe a relationship, maybe a monetary issue, or so, whatever it may be, it is not that he would answer things for you in that sense. He may give his viewpoint. But what I found in the early years when I went to him, I had a crisis at work and I didn't know what to do. And when I went to him and put it in front of him, he said, "We'll see what happens." That was all. We will see what happens. The next time I went to him, he said, "Let it unfold the way it is meant to unfold." So I realized that there's no point going to him if I was looking for specific answers, which many disciples want their gurus to give them. But the beauty of this was, he didn't become a crutch. The words which came from his lips became words to live by. And so with everything that came up in life, all the challenges, all the trials and tribulations, this became the mantra. Just see what happens, let it unfold, witness what happens. Everything is God's will. And that became a way of living. And now I see the beauty of that, because there is no end to the questions we can put forth before gurus and expect answers. That is not the function of the guru. The function of the guru is to take you home to that space where the questions themselves dissolve. They are not answered, they dissolve. Now I will read out two questions which sound extremely similar and raise an important point, which is many times a tremendous misconception, not only on the spiritual journey, but also specifically in the circles of Advaita and non-duality. I am a person who can't say no. I don't have the courage to oppose anything and I try not to hurt anyone. But at the end, I feel I am suffering a lot and people are taking me for granted. Financially too, I help my friend without even considering my necessity. But I feel I have been dumped. is being selfish cruel? And to add to that, so young student, I am yet to do my MBA and build my career, but my parents want me to get married. What do I do? Now, in a similar light, this is someone else who has delved deep into teachings, that's quite clear. But the focal point of the question is the same. I am now 37 and I became a mother last year. This has drastically changed my inner state of being. My heart is constantly overflowing with love and gratitude. But what is happening now is I am awakening to my needs, wants, and life is teaching me more to set boundaries and to stand my ground. The paradox is that the last 5 years I started to walk more intensely the path of Advaita, watching your videos, reading Eckhart Tolle, Muji, and so on. So the vanishing of personhood is happening. But then life teaches me to build a sense of self. This is a bit confusing. You see, this is, firstly, the teachings are not a substitute for therapy. Because all our patterns go to our childhood and the events that transpired there, which we call conditioning. But in both these instances, what Advaita will do, so to speak, is shine the light of clarity. It will not give you the answer, because the answer has to come from within. But what is this light of clarity? This light of clarity is that light which pulls out the thorn of doership from the relationship. Therefore, if, let's say, your parents want you to get married, the understanding is that they have also been conditioned in a certain orthodox way. That is their conditioning. Now you have the thought of pursuing an MBA. That is your thought and feeling. What do I do? When the thorn of doership is pulled out, you honor what is arising because you are not the doer. So if the feeling is that I want to pursue an MBA, you express that feeling because you are honoring what is. You express that feeling knowing that your parents are coming from a certain conditioning. So it is no longer this tremendous opposition of me versus my parents. It is more a space you are in where you understand where they are coming from. And therefore, when you converse with them, you discuss with them, rather than this fight, which usually takes place, there is a discussion. There is more presence brought to that discussion because one has the understanding that nobody truly does anything. Now, the outcome of that discussion is not in anyone's control. Whether you are able to reason with your parents, whether they see your point of view, life will take its course. But what happens is that this discussion takes place now on a sacred ground from which the thorns of doership have been removed. And that is why, even in the Gita, it is said, do what you think and feel you should do, but the results are not in your control. So Advaita will not give you outcomes any differently. But you might be surprised that the whole process which you go through is one with much lesser anguish, stress, pain, blame, and condemnation. That is the gift. Now, coming to this sense of self, we are all trying to please people. Why? Many of us are people pleasers. We want to do things that make people happy, even at our cost. Why? Not from a therapeutic point of view, from a simple looking at the situation, because we have been made that way. First, we must accept that this is not something which we are doing deliberately. Some people are made that way. You are made to want to please people for various reasons. Let's say I feel validated, I feel loved, whatever it may be. We won't get into that. One has been made and conditioned, and maybe genetics play a part in it, to be that way. Now what happens is we derive a sense of self from that. I did something and therefore people like me. That is the sense of doership. If I don't do something, people will not like me. So the ghost of doership is once again standing in the foreground. Now, if your past was one of pleasing people, making them like you, and now you come across a teaching, or you feel in your own life things have changed, you have the experience now that you have suffered as a result of this process, and you want to make a change. Therefore, once again, do exactly what you think and feel you should do. Why? Because that is what is arising right now. So if your own interior structure of thinking has changed and you were doing something else earlier, and now you feel like, now I need to stand my ground, I need to have my boundaries, that is to be honored as well. Because that is what is arising. But you have to be careful, because are those thoughts and feelings arising because you feel others are doing certain things to you? Once again, the sense of doership has to be looked at, because then that would create an additional layer of doership. So therefore, to honor change, change in thoughts, feelings, and emotions, is actually to go with the flow. Because it shows you that transformation on the journey of life is happening and needs to be honored. But to be careful that I am not finger pointing in this process, that people are doing things to me, therefore I want boundaries. That is a very tricky one. Because the teaching is to accept that people are precisely the way they are, the way God has made them, just as the way God has made you. Now, with that understanding, when one sets up boundaries, then that boundary is set up with awareness, with no malice or condemnation or hatred or judgments against the other, as a result of which I'm setting up this boundary. So this is something which, with deep introspection, one can gain tremendous insights. But whether or not one sets up boundaries and so on, whatever is going to happen after that, one has no control. And this whole concept of the vanishing of personhood is one which is actually like walking in quicksand. Because we all are shaped by our genetics and our conditioning. How can you eradicate that which was not created by you in the first place? Where is the question of that vanishing? We are all persons, we are embodied. We have been given a set of attributes on the basis of which we take decisions and have feelings. So it is not the vanishing of personhood, because we are all unique individuals in that sense. And to operate in life in duality, it is people who are operating. What needs to vanish is not the personhood, but the sense of doership. If my nature is to be timid, so to speak, the understanding that this is how consciousness, God, the source, has made me, I have not done anything to be timid. That understanding is the vanishing of the sense of doership, not of the person. We have to interact in life as people. Imagine everyone interacting with the vanishing of the sense of personhood. Would it be possible? So it all depends what is meant by personhood. But according to this teaching, it is not the person which is the problem. It is the sense of doership, which is the thorn which has to be pulled out from the flesh. So in that sense, it may differ from other teachings. But its gift is a sense of deep peace, because you accept yourself as you are, you accept people as they are, especially people you do not like, and that is the healing balm which all your relationships get covered with. And that is why in A Course in Miracles it is said that the holy place is not a temple but a relationship. Because ultimately, if all there is consciousness, then your relationship with others is your relationship with yourself.